What if the trade war really did go on forever? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizal. It is Monday today, the 2nd of November, 2020. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Yes, 2020, which means it's been a bit more than a year since President Trump said this at that big NATO summit in London.
I think in some ways it's better to wait till after the election with China. But I'm not going to say that. I just think that. I just tell you, in some ways, I like the idea of waiting till after the election for the China deal.
Well, since Election Day 2020 is tomorrow in the parallel universe of this program right now, we thought it would be a good idea to get a couple of our trade and economist regulars on the phone to see how the last year has played out in these days of endless trade war.
It's been very busy. We answer an awful lot of questions for our customers.
That's Gretchen Blau. She's the customs broker out of Erie, Pennsylvania, we've been talking to since way back in 2018 when the trade war was young.
Like I said, it is busy. We've added some staff because we have to field so many questions. We're getting more into consultation with our customers. And I mean, that's a service we can offer as well, besides, you know, just doing clearances on imported goods. So, I mean, that's good for us.
So if tariffs and endless trade wars are your business, 2018 and 2019 and this year, 2020, have been pretty good. What they have done to some businesses, though, not so good.
I think really the die was cast for all this back in December of 2019 when we saw an escalation again in tariffs.
Brian Duncan's our hog farmer. He was reelected as the vice president of the Illinois Farm Bureau just before those extra tariffs went into effect. That was December the 15th of 19, which means for all of this year, for all of 2020, we have had tariffs on virtually everything we import from China. And since then, says Brian Duncan,
we've sat here and watched other countries get our business and continue to trade with China while we here in American agriculture miss opportunities.
What's more, says Renee Bowen, the director of the Center for Commerce and Diplomacy at UC San Diego, even if a trade deal does come after Election Day, as the president hinted at back in London last December, and again, in our parallel universe, that is tomorrow, Election Day 2020. Even if there is a deal day after tomorrow, it's not like everything's fine.
One of the interesting things is not so much what we're seeing now in 2020, but what we're going to be seeing in 2021.
What firms know now is that the trade war is going to continue, and in some sense, that provides them some certainty.
That's Kyle Handley at the University of Michigan Ross School of Business. He went on.
It also creates new uncertainties because they don't know what country is going to get hit by import tariffs next, and they don't know what country may respond by retaliating against those tariffs and what products they will retaliate against. And so in many ways, the business environment, at least if you're an international or multinational firm, is as uncertain as it's ever been.
Uncertainty and make-believe 2020 future days of endless trade wars. Uncertainty back here in present day 2019 as well. Another round of tariffs due in 2 weeks. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross said this afternoon President Trump has not ruled out automobile tariffs in days to come. And we'll have more trade war content in about 30 seconds or so. Wall Street on this Tuesday, December 3rd, 2019. Not so happy. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It has been a day in global trade, no matter the year we're talking about. We are firmly back in 2019 for the rest of the program, by the by. And if the China trade war is topic A, topic B on this Tuesday is surely the contretemps between the U.S. and France. Last night, the Trump administration proposed 100% tariffs on about $2.5 billion worth of French imports to this country. A clapback, if you will, to a digital tax that France passed over the summer aimed at getting a bigger slice of the profits tech companies are making over there. Amazon, Facebook, Google, of course, topping that list. 3%, here are the specifics, 3% on digital companies with more than 25 million euros in French-generated content. Other EU countries are thinking along the same lines, so we have gotten Molly Wood on the phone. She is, of course, the host of Marketplace Tech to help sort out the escalating digital tax fracas. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Guy.
So, I had a much deal of fracas, right? What is it?
I mean, that was so good.
What? Help us understand this. What is at the root of these proposed taxes? Because the Europeans, of course, have no love for big American tech companies.
Right, and I think it is in some ways easy to conflate those two things, the kind of general backlash against big U.S. tech companies and this digital tax conversation. There is probably an element of that in here, but it's also, to me, kind of a sign of the borderlessness of the digital economy.
Hmm.
You know, so these countries are saying, look, a lot of business is being transacted here. Let's say our citizens are using Google for all of their searches. They're shopping on Amazon. They're engaging in all of this commerce that generates revenue.
Yeah.
And that revenue, none of it is realized by the countries where all of this commerce and all of this business has happened, right? It goes back to those companies, and it might go via Ireland and then eventually end up in the United States. And they're saying, listen, there's no French search engine benefiting here, but a lot of commerce is happening. And so we would like a cut of that. And not for nothing, we have some economic troubles, and it would really help us if we got a cut of that. But I think it's reasonable to sort of compare it to Amazon back in the day having to ultimately charge sales tax in every state because they said there's business happening, there's commerce happening, and revenue is being incurred in this country. We should get a cut.
All right. So look, if I am Jeff Bezos running Amazon or Mark Zuckerberg running Facebook or Sundar Pichai, who was named today to head Alphabet, Google's parent company, as well as Google, I have to navigate 28 different economies over there, 27 once Brexit happens. But it's not an uncomplicated problem, right, with varying tax rates and all of that.
Exactly. And so while it might seem like a perfectly fair solution to say that everybody should get a cut of the revenue that's being generated in their country or their city, it is, in fact, a giant mess. You know, you got your 3% in France or Italy, 7.5% in Turkey. It would become a huge burden because it could be a tax, a patchwork of lots of different rates. So you have companies, of course, fighting back with lawsuits and lobbying and trying to sort of make this political because, yeah, they absolutely don't want to have to do this in every country where they do business. And it could eventually, even for the big guys, become somewhat cost prohibitive.
So on the theory that there will eventually be a solution, what might that look like? Will there be some kind of pan-European deal? Or, I mean, what are we talking here?
It's so interesting because we are actually in uncharted territory with respect to global taxation. And I think it's going to get kind of fascinating if you're into that sort of thing. France has said,
raise your hand, you know.
So many hands just shot into the air. I know it. France has said that it would prefer an EU-wide agreement or even a global agreement. The OECD, which is the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, basically like a global economic forum, has been talking about ways to address the idea of sort of global digital taxation, maybe with a standard, which seems like the most obvious course forward. But they have only been talking, and they've been talking for about 2 years now. So I don't know that we can expect any action soon. I think things will be stuck in lawsuits and lobbying for a little while longer.
All right. You got 30 seconds to answer this one. And let's roll in where we started, which is Europe not being wild about American tech companies and the whole GDPR privacy thing. Does this escalate? Do the tensions between European countries and big tech firms escalate, do you think? Because there's got to be another step to this.
I think there's another step, but I have a hard time believing that it is escalation because these countries are really stuck between a rock and a hard place. They actually do need the revenue, and they're trying to, especially in the case of the UK, which is, you know, looking, staring down Brexit, they're trying to lure these tech companies' headquarters to London. So I actually think that the tech companies are probably in a strong position here.
It's a global economy. We just live in it. Molly Wood, she's the host of Marketplace Tech, and with me, a podcast we do together called Make Me Smart. Molly, thanks a lot. Talk to you soon.
Thanks, Kai.
All right. Bye-bye. All All right, totally new topic now. Batteries, arguably the challenge of our electric vehicle future. Getting a reliable, portable, and powerful enough power source that is also cheap enough to get us to where we need to go. And on that topic, some news. Prices for batteries have been tumbling down 87% over the past decade for the battery packs that go into electric cars and energy storage systems. Those prices are still falling, by the way. That's all from a new report from the clean energy research firm Bloomberg NEF. And as Marketplace's Jack Stewart reports, those prices are about to hit a magic number that should make electric vehicles more price competitive with the internal combustion kind.
Battery storage is measured in kilowatt hours. A large battery for an electric vehicle is around 100 kilowatt hours. And back in 2010, the average cost for that would have been $11,000. Now it's just over $1,500.
The decline in battery prices, it just keeps astounding even all the experts.
Costa Samaras researches energy and climate change at Carnegie Mellon University.
Nobody thought that it would drop this far this fast.
It did, thanks to improvements in manufacturing, battery chemistry, and tighter supply chain control. And the biggest beneficiaries, he says, are electric vehicles.
It's really, really important for cars to be electrified in order to deal with climate change, and the cheap battery is at the center of that.
The Bloomberg NEF report says by 2024, prices could fall to $100 per kilowatt hour, and that's where EVs won't have to rely on subsidies to cost about the same as conventional cars. Jeff Huron at SBD Automotive says the number one concern for potential electric vehicle buyers is price.
And when you think about the cost of an electric vehicle, anywhere from one-third to one-half of that cost is because of the battery.
That dramatic decline in price means it's now cost-effective to use batteries for other applications, says Sonia Agarwal at the think tank Energy Innovation.
It's going to make a huge difference for household energy use and for the power grid.
Giant batteries hooked up to the grid help balance energy demand so utilities don't have to fire up gas-powered plants at peak times. In houses, they help store solar energy for use at night. Of course, all this means demand for batteries is also growing. But experts say, at the moment, it looks like supply will keep up and prices will continue down. I'm Jack Stewart for Marketplace.
Coming up.
And the next week, this photo was in Us Weekly magazine.
How one picture was worth 100,000 diapers. But first, let's do the numbers. The prospect of endless trade wars did a number on equities today. The Dow Industrial's off 280 points, 1%, closed at 27,502, down about 1.5% at the bottom were the blue chips. The NASDAQ down 47 points, about 0.5%, 85.20. S&P 500 down 20 points, 0.6%, 3,093. Apple, which could be hit hard by new tariffs on Chinese goods, set to start in 12 days, down 1.7%. Amazon slid for a second day, dropping 0.2%. Today, Netflix down as well after a Citigroup report that said the streaming service is going to need to raise prices if it is going to keep growing. The stock down 1.2% on the day. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 1.71%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. It was, as you just heard, the sad music today, days of endless trade wars and all that. But as iconic as we here at Marketplace would like to believe the sad or the happy music is, free market capitalism does have another sonic signature. The sounds that begin and end the trading day. Marketplace's Justin Ho has that one.
It's nearly 9:30 in the morning. The trading day is about to officially begin. Right now, a few players from the Harlem Globetrotters are standing on the marble balcony above the bustling trading floor of the New York Stock Exchange. At the moment, they're tossing basketballs back and forth with the crowd below. Finally, it's time. Harlem Globetrotter Big Easy Lofton is pressing the button that rings the bell. With his other hand, he's spinning a ball on his index finger. Lofton's supposed to ring the opening bell for 10 seconds. The closing bell rings longer.
You must hold that button down for 15 seconds. They tell you that if you don't hold the button down for 15 seconds, then the members are going to boo you that you didn't do it correctly.
That's Jim Sheehan, the CFO of Hormel Foods, the company behind Spam, Columbus Meats, and Skippy Peanut Butter. Back in October, the exchange invited the company to ring the closing bell. 15 minutes before it happened, Hormel's CEO surprised Sheehan by giving him the job of pressing the button.
You know, I've been with the company for 41 years, so I've had a long career with the company. It's one of those things that is almost a culmination of a career for me.
The exchange has used brass bells to bookend the trading day ever since 1903. Before that, it used a Chinese gong. And usually, exchange officials would ring the bell. Then, in 1995, the NYSE started inviting companies to do the honors. John Steele Gordon is a Wall Street historian. He says it was the early days of the dot-com boom. TV news was covering more of what was happening on Wall Street, and companies realized that ringing the bell could give them a little publicity.
And the stock exchange was more than happy to make this available because it gave the New York Stock Exchange good publicity, too.
People end up on the marble balcony for all sorts of reasons. Executives ring the bell when their companies go public or if they're releasing a new product. The Harlem Globetrotters are about to start an international tour. Betty Liu is the exchange's executive vice chairman.
This year alone, you know, Uber, for instance, of course, rang it for their IPO and they had one of their drivers ring the bell. We had First Lady Melania Trump come recently and she rang the bell.
It almost to me feels like when you give away the key to the city.
That's Ian Bremmer, founder of the consulting firm Eurasia Group.
Like, you know, the mayor does that. It's kind of this honorific in a place that a lot of things seem ephemeral. It's something that we've been doing for an awful long time.
He's rung the bell twice, once in 2009 and again in 2018 after he started a new media company called G-Zero Media. Both times, he said the stock exchange invited him.
It was like, yeah, it's a great new company you're doing, and why don't you come when you have a chance? Let's figure out a time that you guys can come and ring the bell. I mean, that wasn't something we were lobbying for.
Betty Liu didn't divulge how the selection process works, but there's a request form on the NYSE website. The form says the bell's reserved for public companies listed on the exchange, but sometimes there are last-minute opportunities for, quote, deserving nonprofit organizations.
We were on our way to present our work at a fundraiser and got this call at 6:30 the evening before the bell was supposed to be rung.
That's Becca DeMeo. She's the executive director of City Growers, a nonprofit that teaches young people about farming. Apparently, the company that was supposed to ring the bell had dropped out.
The chair of the board of City Growers, Georgia, she called and just said, hey, do you guys want to ring the opening bell for the New York Stock Exchange? And I was like, oh, is that a thing? Is that something we should do? And Georgia was like, yes, Becca, it's definitely something we should do.
DeMeo had 30 minutes to throw together a list of people who would be there. She brought along a few colleagues. City Growers program manager Renelle St. Jor pressed the button.
I was really excited about it because I did learn about ringing the bell in school. I study economics.
Watching St. Jor ring the bell, you can tell he's excited. He beams as he presses the button, with his fist in the air.
Yeah, I was trying to pump the market. I was trying to make sure it was a good day.
After ringing the bell, St. Jor signed the wall in the back room and went home with a plaque. That day, the S&P 500 and the Dow closed up. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Regular listeners will know that we talk on a pretty regular basis with the CEOs of companies that shape our everyday lives. You can listen to those interviews in their entirety, by the way, on our Corner Office podcast. But those companies are mostly big, entirely for profit, and generally corporate companies. For the next couple of weeks, though, we're going to talk to people running nonprofits and charities, which, it has to be said here, also shape people's lives. We start with co-presidents of an organization called Baby to Baby. Kelly Sawyer Patrickoff and Nora Weinstein run the thing. Nora started us off when they came into the studio the other day with the elevator pitch.
Well, our elevator pitch is very simple, and it's that we provide diapers, clothing, and basic essentials to children in poverty who deserve them. And I say that it's simple because it's really a very old-fashioned form of charity. People generally want to help children in need, and we give them a very tangible way to do so.
There are, though, Kelly, dozens, hundreds of organizations with a very similar mission statement. Mm-hmm. What's your business differentiator?
I think we've always looked at Baby to Baby as a business, and we've never looked at it as something that was going to be small and that was going to help few. And I think people got behind us because, no, like, There's no food stamps don't cover diapers. These families are paying up to 14% of their income on diapers. It's so expensive. And when you really like look at these facts, you can't imagine being in this situation and not being able to put a diaper on your baby. You're emptying your baby's diaper out and hanging it to dry and putting it back on your baby. Those are the realities that the families we serve are facing.
Nora,
can I chime into that?
Yeah, of course you can. Go ahead.
I don't know that there's hundreds or thousands of organizations doing similar work. There are some, and we partner with them and admire them and want there to be more and more. But we're truly a middleman to these other organizations, where we are solely focused on getting them diapers, clothing, car seats, strollers, warm clothing, pajamas, bottles, formula, school uniforms, backpacks. And there are actually not that many.
So it's sourcing and then distribution, right? So in essence, you two are running a logistics company.
We are.
Yes.
We found ourselves running
right.
a logistics company.
Right.
Not what we thought when we started.
Well, no. But look, you and this company and where we are in this city, you two come with a differentiator. And that is the role of influencers and celebrities and your social circles that have permitted you to expand. How did that come to pass? Did you just like call Jessica Alba and say, hey, do you have some spare diapers?
It's funny. We tell this story a lot. And we had a event where we begged our friends to help us get alcohol sponsors and space sponsored and all these things. And we invited Jessica Alba and Nicole Ritchie, who are two of our founding board members. And one of our friends who was in PR, who happened to help us out that night.
Yeah, always somebody who knows somebody. Right?
Yeah, brought a photographer and we took a photo. And the next week, this photo was in Us Weekly magazine. And it said the Baby to Baby event with Jessica Alba and Nicole Ritchie. We weren't in the photo, but we're okay. and then we're at our 600-square-foot warehouse. And we got a phone call, and it was like, hello, this is Edelman PR, and we'd like to throw an event with you, and we'd like to give you 100,000 diapers and $100,000.
They represented Kimberly Clark, who...
Pampers, right?
Huggies.
Sorry. Oh, my God. Underwrite us again.
Yeah, so we were in the business of saying yes, and as they were saying, do you accept pallets? We were like, what is a pallet? And we were like, of course we accept pallets. And they were like, do you have a forklift? And we were like, yeah, we have a forklift. We had no forklift. We had nothing. And the truck showed up with the 100,000 diapers, and we unloaded it ourselves with our one intern in our heels.
And they flew off the shelves.
Yeah,
and
sure.
We realized that early on that utilizing these influencers and celebrities could be a key to our success and growth. So we've continued to surround ourselves with a group of women, both board members and an extension of our board that we call our angel group. And they're not names on pieces of paper. They are women, and they are all mothers, and they bring in their own companies to volunteer. They also give us millions of items from companies that they've started. They do similar events where, in return for a sponsorship, they will pose for a photograph that allows us to get millions of dollars and millions of items. So we've utilized them, and it's really worked.
So there's a growth and scale question to be asked, right? So how are you going to grow this in a way that lets you stay true to your mission when there's so much opportunity and need?
Sure. So I would start by saying I'm going back to the narrow mission, because what we have found is we have identified this category of need, which is for these basic essentials, and it is not stopping. We have at all times a wait list representing over 50,000 children in Los Angeles alone. The numbers in the country are exponentially more than that. And every homeless shelter, hospital, domestic violence shelter, school district that hears about us says, we would love to be a part of this. So we're not interested in growing beyond the mission of doing that. We're interested in reaching more children with the mission that we've already established.
Nora Weinstein, Kelly Sawyer Patrickoff, the company's called Baby to Baby. Thanks you two for coming in.
Thank you.
The extended version of that interview, Kelly Sawyer Patrickoff and Nora Weinstein, the co-presidents of Baby to Baby, Baby to Baby, is on our Corner Office podcast, including, by the way, how that whole co-president thing works. The This final note on the way out today, which struck a chord because I spent part of my morning digging out Uber receipts for my latest expense reports. The rideshare company is out with its, just a tad early, it has to be said, year-end lists. The most Ubered to tourist attraction in the world? The Empire State Building. Number two, Freedom Tower, just a reasonably short subway ride away, I will point out. The most popular day to take an Uber? The Saturday of St. Patrick's Day weekend. All right, we got to go. No, really, we do. Dow Industrials off 280 points today, 1%. The NASDAQ down 47 points, about a half percent. S&P 500 down 20.6 tenths of 1%. Our digital and on-demand team includes Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Brian Ronahan, and Tony Wagner. Sitar Nieves is our executive director of on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.